Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, new developments in solar power, radio in Ireland, video phones, the future of conversation, digital compact cassette versus digital audio tape, AM stereo in the UK, and a new deal for jazz on the airwaves. Plus, of course, your letters. This is Sparks, every week from Radiofax.
I am the world.
Sparks this week is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook.
Now it's to my favourite part of the world again, to County Cork in Ireland, and a piece by Maggie Taylor about Irish radio. In spite of a difficult advertising climate that hit most stations the first few months of operation, Ireland's pioneers in government-regulated radio are surviving, and the scene appears set to grow. The government authorised 26 stations and a new nationwide independent station since it began issuing licences in 1989. Until now, there were only two national stations and an Irish language station, all run by Radio Telefish Éireann, RTE. Many local stations, both commercial and community, used to broadcast without licences. The authorities mostly regarded them as unlicensed rather than illegal operations because there were no procedures for authorisation. Between 1988 and 1989, the Irish government, like that of many countries throughout Europe, adopted legislation to regulate local radio. In October 1990, Horizon Radio and Radio Kilkenny were the first of the newly licensed stations to go on air, all broadcasting on the FM band. Most of the others began broadcasting in early 1990. The last to reach the airwaves was the Sligo-based Northwest Radio that began broadcasting in November 1990. Northwest Radio covers counties Sligo, North Leitrim and South Donegal, broadcasting on 102.5 FM and 96.3 FM. The station is partly owned by Midwest Radio, that has the franchise for County Mayo. Northwest Radio broadcasts its own programmes for 12 hours and takes 6 hours from Midwest Radio. In their Sligo studio, Northwest Radio has the MBI Series 16 broadcast desks and BBC-designed Harbeth acoustics monitor speakers. They also have Technics turntables, Sony DAT machines, NAD CDs and Revox PR99 open reel tape recorders. Revox equipment and Ela mixers are popular with many stations, other stations as well. A number of the local stations have chosen Selector for music programming, LMFM being the latest to have this installed. While most counties only have one licence, Wicklow has two and Tipperary has three. One of the three in Tipperary, Active Link Tipperary North, has not begun broadcasting. There are ongoing talks with the other two stations, Tipperary Midwest Radio and the Southwest Tipperary franchise, Siorland Radio, on the possibility of all three combining. The chief executive of Ireland's Independent Television and Radio Commission, Mick O'Keefe, said recently that a few too many franchises may have been issued. If we were doing it again, there are a number of areas, such as Wicklow and Tipperary, where one franchise would have been sufficient. There are other stations that cover more than one county. Radio LMFM, based on the border with Northern Ireland at Drogheda, covers County Louth and North Meath. Carlow Kildare Radio covers Carlow and Kildare, while Radio 3, the Voice of the Midlands, covers counties Laois, Offaly and West Meath. Shannonside 104 FM covers Roscommon, Longford and South Leitrim, while Northern Sound Radio covers counties Cavan and Monaghan. One of the stations that did exceptionally well in a recent listener survey was Radio Kerry. The survey showed more than 40% of all radio listeners in County Kerry were tuned into the station. Radio Kerry overtook the national RTE stations Radio 1 and 2 FM in their area, as did 96 FM in Cork. Another survey showed that local stations generally were making gains and increasing listenership, especially at weekends. Now that most are in their second year of broadcasting, some changes are in the pipeline. Talks are underway to set up an independent radio news service. Presently, 17 local stations take news from the national independent station Century Radio, while the others provide their own news. Under the licence rules, all stations have to provide 20% news and current affairs. This can include things like film reviews and community events. The Dublin-based Century Radio is supposed to have a stake in the new service that should include more local news content than the present service and contributions from local stations. Following a survey by the Independent Radio and Television Commission, another plan is being discussed to establish a central advertising sales bureau for local stations outside of Dublin. This would help them coordinate at least a portion of their advertising. Maggie Taylor there in Radio World.
In Electronics Weekly, British buy more TVs and videos by Carl Schneider. British households are chock-a-block with more consumer electronics goodies than almost any other homes in Europe, according to a mammoth survey of European consumers published last week by Reader's Digest. People in Britain own more TVs, video recorders and home computers than their counterparts anywhere else in Europe, and come second in ownership of audio equipment. Conducted last summer, the Eurodata Consumer Survey interviewed more than 22,000 people in 17 European countries on subjects ranging from alcohol consumption to political outlook. An overwhelming 98% of all UK homes have a TV set, only slightly higher than the European average of 97%. But Britons lead the way in multiple TV ownership. 36% of households have two sets, and almost one in five have three or more, higher than anywhere else in Europe. British TVs are also newer on average than those of the continent. 40% of UK households bought their main TV set in the past 3 years, compared to a European average of 33%. Almost three-fifths of all UK homes have a video recorder, again more than anywhere else in Europe, the average being just two-fifths. However, only 4% have a satellite dish, about average for Europe, and an unimpressive 9% of homes are connected to cable TV, well below the European average of 21%. In audio equipment, Britons lead Europe in ownership of personal stereos, 35% of people, and come second to Holland for radio and cassette players, 63% and 81% respectively. But only a fifth of Britain owns a CD player, less than in Holland, Luxembourg, Germany, Belgium, or France. Britain also tops the league table in home computer ownership, featuring in 22% of households. 6% have cordless telephones, but despite the yuppie boom of the 1980s, only 4% of UK homes have a mobile telephone. The average for Europe is 7%. This is Sparks on Radio Facts. I'd love to have a letter from you and promise to read it out on air. The address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply in writing, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, and the address Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
Gee, but it's great to be back home. Home is where I want to be. I've been on the road so long, my friend. And if you came along, I know you couldn't disagree. It's the same old story, yeah. Everywhere I go, I get slandered. Sheriff said to me, tell me what you come here for, boy. You better get your bags and flee. You're in trouble, boy, and now you're heading into war. It's the same old story. Everywhere I go, I get slandered. Satisfied, satisfied.
Now a piece from California by Mel Lambert about digital compact cassette. The technology spotlight has been playing on a new consumer recording replay format that, at the very least, is muddying the digital audio tape water. DCC, or Digital Compact Cassette, is Philips's remarkable innovation designed to replace the familiar analog cassette. In a nutshell, DCC uses 1/8-inch chromium dioxide tape to record up to 120 minutes of digital audio in an enclosed housing the same size as a conventional cassette. Unlike analog cassettes, however, the shell is single-sided, with the top surface reserved for graphics and other information. The tape also is protected by a metal shutter that is automatically moved to one side by the DCC transport, much like the metal shield used by some CD caddy manufacturers. The DCC format is bidirectional, offering up to 60 minutes of recording time in either tape direction. The record replay heads feature 8 data tracks per 2 channels and have been positioned specifically to offer compatibility with all of our existing cassettes. In other words, a DCC player might be engineered to use the same head block with additional replay amplifiers to play back analog recordings as well as the new DCC recordings. Voila! Instant compatibility with the millions of pre-recorded analog cassettes lining our shelves, and a gentle segue for most consumers from boring old analog to pristine new digital. And on paper at least, DCC does have a respectable technical performance. Running at a tape speed of just 1 7/8 inches per second, the same as the analog cassette, the 8 data tracks allow a companded, digitized stereo signal to be recorded and replayed, utilizing a familiar 8-10 modulation system and Reed-Solomon error protection codes. The end result is a quoted frequency response of 5 Hz to 22 kHz at a sampling frequency of 44.1 kHz. Dynamic range in excess of 105 dB and total harmonic distortion plus noise below 92 dB. DCC consumer decks are scheduled to be available for purchase in mid-1992, and word from Philips is that they will also feature SCMS copyright protection circuitry to prevent unauthorized digital-to-digital copying by the consumer. Where does that leave DAT, the much heralded digital replacement for consumer analog recording hardware? Within the strictly consumer marketplace, I would say pretty much dead in the water. It has to be conceded that, with hindsight, compact discs became something of an embarrassment for the record industry and the producers, songwriters, performers, publishers, and others that owned copyright to those recordings. By placing a digital quality master in the hands of the public and making available CD players with direct digital outputs, consumers soon realized that they could make virtually mirror image copies of a CD using the player's optical or SPDIF coax ports. And it was about this time that the first prototype DAT recorders appeared upon the scene. The Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA, and others began to realize that sales of albums and singles were on the decline and chose to point the accusing finger at the home taping fraternity. In essence, the industry watchdogs insisted that anti-copy protection circuitry be included in consumer recorders. First, the sonically degrading copy code notch filters, which the National Bureau of Standards tested and found lacking, and now the SCMS, Serial Copy Management System format. Personally, I feel that home taping was never a significant issue in this anti-copy debate. However, it cannot be denied that the music software industry was running scared at the prospect of placing too good of a recording medium, DAT, in the hands of the consumer. So, to cut to the chase, DAT came in for a great deal of negative publicity, while the various consumer electronic giants looked for a more attractive format. Meanwhile, DAT had taken off in the professional audio industry, with second-generation machines now being introduced, some with IEC format timecode capabilities for use in broadcast, music recording, and post-production facilities. It would appear that the market for ProDAT now has reached critical mass and is sufficiently well established that the format will prove a viable alternative to more expensive video-based digital processors and reel-to-reel transports. On the consumer front, a format was required that could be used to eclipse DAT and meet the anti-copying criteria of software owners. This is, of course, where DCC comes into the picture. Formally unveiled at the Winter Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last year, DCC is a very elegant technical achievement and goes a long way in satisfying the anti-home taping lobby's objections to DAT recorders. In essence, the Philips DCC format utilizes a proprietary data compression technique, based interestingly on the firm's involvement with the Musicam system, to squeeze the appropriate number of bits onto multiplexed linear tape tracks. The coding technique, referred to as PASC or Precision Adaptive Subband Coding, provides, with additional gain stepping, the quoted dynamic range performance. What is not so well advertised, however, is that the fact that, by their very nature, most compression algorithms will prevent analog copying, with SCMS taking care of the digital-to-digital copying. Because the data reduction coding technique is doing so much processing to reduce the number of bits required to produce a recordable signal, including elegant masking analysis and other high-tech number-crunching techniques, to perform the process a second time would produce an audible effect on the copy. So, from Philips's point of view, we have the possibly ideal digital consumer recording format. DCC will handle pre-recorded tapes, and contact print techniques for high-speed duplication of DCC titles are just around the hardware corner. And the home taper is provided with a format that will do an excellent job of making one-time copies of whatever it is they wish to record. But the same factors that make DCC viable for the consumer market also means that it will have little application for professionals. My instincts tell me that DAT will continue to impact the broadcast, post and music industries for several years, to be eclipsed during that period by affordable hard disk and recordable optical recording formats. So, DAT versus DCC? An unfair contest for many reasons, and one in which DAT for broadcast applications will be a clear winner. That piece by Mel Lambert in Radio World. Winter Night Times in the British Isles, also available on 3910. 3910. 16 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie!
Jackie! Jackie!
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
Close enough to really care, as Brent should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
A letter from William Schmitz from Washington, D.C. in the USA. This is just a short note to thank you for verifying my report of September the 22nd broadcast. It was real nice of you to take the time to do that. I also want to thank you for the speed at which you did it. I wish the North American pirate stations would reply that rapidly. Radiofax has a good reputation in North America for being a fast and reliable verifier. Your station is always being praised in the shortwave radio hobby bulletins and newsletters over here for its good verification policy. As for the Voice of America's transmitters going unstable, what else is new? The VOA is one of the biggest polluters of the airwaves. They wreak havoc with the North American pirates ever since they started using 7405 kHz at midnight UTC. You can hear QRM from them all the way up to 7420 kHz. This totally degrades 7415 kHz, which happens to be North America's primary pirate frequency. More and more pirates over here are starting to use sideband now because of the crowded band conditions. Radio USA and Radio Free Massachusetts being two prime examples. Because of poor music fidelity in sideband, these stations are putting more emphasis on talk and information instead of music. In closing, I just want to thank you again for verifying my reception report. Your QSL card is real nice looking, and I display it prominently within my collection. Keep up the good work, and I hope to hear you again soon. Thanks, William Schmitz from Washington, D.C. in the USA.
Dirty poppers that pop in the night. I'd sit by some hairspray plastic with the spray on a corner that's just walked in.
This story was featured in a recent news item on Sparks, and here's an in-depth article in Electronics Weekly. Power from the Sky. Richard Wilson catches up on the latest developments in the world of solar energy conversion. Converting sunlight into electrical energy is not very efficient, but it is attractive to an environmentally conscious world. No longer only the novelty value of throwaway calculators, solar panels are used to power telephone equipment and oil pipeline monitors. But with typical cell efficiencies of around 10%, solar cells are far from ideal. While manufacturers continue to nibble away at the efficiency and stability problems, breakthrough discoveries more often than not never make it beyond the laboratory. Research into photovoltaic cells follows two well-trodden paths. The first cells were made from bulk crystalline silicon junctions, and these still produce the most efficient commercially manufactured cells. The drive for a more usable solar cell design inevitably leads companies to investigate the use of thin films of semiconductor materials, such as silicon and gallium arsenide, deposited on a glass substrate. Light will generate an electrical current when its optical energy or flux is sufficient to free electrons, creating electron-hole pairs close to a semiconductor p-n junction. To do this, the photons need an energy of around 1.5 electron volts. This is an intrinsically inefficient process, with energy lost in heat and recombination. Most of the world's solar cells are based on monocrystalline silicon structures, which can be manufactured in reasonable volumes. Companies are improving the efficiencies of these devices by maximizing the light which falls on the cell, and by minimizing electrical energy loss due to the semiconductor impurities at the junction. One of the UK's largest suppliers of solar cells is BP Solar, a division of the UK Oil Company. The company has recently started pilot production of a monocrystalline cell, which it claims has an energy conversion efficiency of 18%. Much of BP's current work is designing these cells into practical modules, which will be used to power homesteads in Australia. Dr. John Harford of BP Solar says current modules typically produce 60 watts per square metre of silicon. With a typical house requiring 3 kilowatt or 10 modules, there is still a need to cut costs by increasing efficiency or reducing the amount of silicon used. Crystalline cells are cut from ingots of bulk silicon into 300 micron wafers. The wastefulness of this process was one factor behind the development of cells produced by depositing 10 micron films of silicon on glass. In the last 10 years, a lot of money has been spent on thin film cell structures, such as amorphous silicon, with limited success. According to Dr. Halford, the devices have lower efficiencies than crystalline cells, and more importantly are unstable, with 20% power degradation observed in a year's operation. The problem is the reliability of the amorphous silicon, and manufacturers are looking at using other materials to improve cell stability and efficiency. BP's research has led it to cadmium telluride, which Dr. Halford says is simpler to deposit than silicon and is more stable. BP researchers have made a 300mm square cell, which Dr. Halford claims has a 10% efficiency across its complete area. With current cell efficiencies struggling to reach 20%, solar cell technology is seen by many university researchers as ripe for a major breakthrough. Last month, two groups of researchers in the UK and Switzerland claimed to have found it. Researchers at Imperial College in London claimed they had built a cell with an efficiency of 40%. To achieve this, the group redesigned the physical structure of the photovoltaic cell. Instead of relying on the current generated at a single gallium arsenide PN junction, the researchers have increased the electron hole capture rate by creating a number of quantum well structures. The wells are similar to those used in gallium arsenide and lasers, and at their boundaries they act like the PN junction by forcing the electron hole to split, creating a current. According to Dr. Keith Barnum of Imperial College, efficiency is increased because the wells can capture low-energy electrons which would not cross the PN junction band gap. A large number, typically 50, wells can be created in a single cell structure. The problem with such a technique is taking it out of the laboratory and into the commercial world. Scientists at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne have addressed that issue head-on by making a cell that can match the efficiency of the best amorphous silicon cells, but which they claim will be cheap to make and stable. Instead of silicon, the Swiss cell uses particles of titanium dioxide deposited in a 10-micron film. The advantage of using the nanometer-sized TiO particles is that it increases the surface area of the film and the amount of optical energy collected. In addition, a light-sensitive dye is used to optimize light capture, and researchers are claiming a 46% capture rate. But nothing is that easy in solar cell development, and much of the benefits are lost in the overall conversion process. An overall energy efficiency of 12% in diffuse daylight has been recorded. Progress is slow, and the solar cell industry is used to disappointments, but still the work goes on. As Dr. Barnum points out, a 50% efficient cell no bigger than 2 square meters could meet a household's electricity needs. Such is the attraction of the ultimate in an environmentally friendly energy source. Power from the Sky from Electronics Weekly.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear too, memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, PO Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, PO Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
You're listening to Radio Facts. Today's programme, Sparks, our weekly look at science, technology and the media.
The UK evaluates AM stereo by John Gatsky in Radio World. UK broadcasters could transmit AM stereo within the next year, but the agency governing radio transmissions wants interference calculations on the likely standard, Motorola CQAM. The Radio Communications Agency, a division of the Department of Trade and Industry, has briefed the Association of Independent Radio Contractors on its inquiry into AM stereo. The adoption of CQAM looks very promising because Japanese tests revealed CQAM is compatible with the 9 kHz bandwidth AM scheme used in the UK, according to Capital Radio's engineering director Peter Jackson. He suggested the Radio Communication Agency could approve CQAM within a year. Stations could have the system on the air in 3 to 6 months, he added. The Radio Communications Agency requested CCIR interference profile calculations following tests last year by the now-defunct Independent Broadcasting Authority, which rated CQAM highly. The IBA tests, which included on-air broadcasts and laboratory comparisons of two American AM stereo systems, Motorola CQAM and the Kahn ISB systems, said CQAM is an inherently better system, according to Jackson. Those test results, however, were not enough to persuade the government. The Radio Communications Agency wanted CCIR standard-based interference calculations, an area not covered in the comparison tests. Jackson said such tests would have been too expensive for the newly created National Transcommunications Limited, a privately funded spin-off of the IBA. NTL instead decided to use the Japanese report that includes CCIR calculations. Motorola provided the translation from Japanese to English, while the NTL compiled the summary report that was to be forwarded to the Radio Communications Agency. United Kingdom stations like the idea of AM stereo because it will be a good marketing tool for the band, which Jackson said benefits from a change in the UK broadcasting regulations that ends simulcasting of AM and FM programmes. Stereo will give a boost to AM's unique programming. Receiver companies have indicated to UK broadcasters that producing CQAM radios is a matter of scheduling production once the demand is stimulated. During the meeting with the Radio Communication Agency, Jackson said RDS AM was also discussed. Germany has proposed an RDS system for AM, and there has been some debate about whether it is compatible with CQAM. Preliminary tests by Motorola, he said, concluded that compatibility is possible. Jackson said he has heard that Europe would rather have RDS AM than AM stereo, but he does not believe it. No actual systems exist, he said. At least with AM stereo we can get on with it and get something out of it. Jackson does not believe DAB, digital audio broadcasting, will have an immediate effect on AM stereo if it's adopted within the year. Even if DAB is adopted in 1995, it will be 8 to 10 years before it has significant market penetration. Broadcasters who convert it to AM stereo will have recouped their investment in equipment by that time and benefited from the reputation of better sound. That piece by John Gatsky.
New government proposals have raised fears that the explosion in mobile communications could blight Britain's towns and cities with radio antennae. A consultation document from the Department of the Environment is proposing to relax existing restrictions which control the size and location of radio masts in towns and cities. Planning Minister Sir George Young said the government wanted to encourage the development of telecommunication systems. "We do not want the planning system to pose unnecessary obstacles to this development," he added. He is proposing the cellular telephone and personal communications operations will find it easier to install radio base stations by removing height and location restrictions. The DOE is proposing that the current height limit on radio masts be raised from 15 to 20 metres. There will be no limit on the number of dishes attached to buildings above 15 metres high and masts, as long as their area does not exceed 3 square metres.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofact Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Face Up to the Future of Conversations, a piece about video telephones in the Financial Times by Christopher Price. The phone rings, you push your video phone smart card into your PC, and a voice on the line says hi as a face on the computer screen mouths the words. Above the monitor, on a tiny tripod, a camera the size of a finger flickers, and across the world, you can be seen as well as heard. Far-fetched? Hardly. In December, several of Europe's leading telecoms operators will begin pan-European trials of video telephones, some of which will be embedded in personal computers. These are expected to lead to a service for business users beginning by the end of 1992. A service for home users is likely to be operational a year later. Picture telephones, as they were formerly known, have been under serious technological consideration for a number of years. Developments in the video conferencing area have brought the prospect much closer, but it is the spread of digital telephone networks, or ISDN, which has given the project its greatest boost. Picture quality has been one of the biggest problems dogging development. Conventional analog telephone lines do not have the capability to transmit information in either the capacity or quality that make developments such as video telephones viable. Digital networks have solved the first part of the equation by allowing more complex information to be sent at a lower cost and higher quality. Since January, an ISDN service has been available in Britain to all major business users. BT says as the network expands, so will the facilities available and the number of customers able to be connected. ISDN has spurred manufacturers and operators to develop integrated equipment capable of transmitting and receiving high-quality moving pictures along telephone lines. Advances in codec, coder and decoder compressing devices, which digitalize visual images, has meant the 140 megabits per second of transmission space needed has now been compressed to just 64 kilobits per second, the carrying capacity of an ISDN line. The effect is to reduce the potential cost of using the video telephone to that of a normal telephone call, although there will be some loss of quality. However, the restricted coverage of ISDN is cause for some concern. British Telecom is working on one design which will incorporate a 4-inch camera set into a terminal with a 9x4-inch screen and telephone. Another design incorporates just the camera and screen and would be adaptable to existing office and home telephones. It is the conversion card, which will take the form of a 4x8-inch printed circuit board for PCs under development, which offers the most exciting business potential. It will fit into the expansion slot normally reserved for extra memory or graphic facility and allow the PC to transmit and receive video pictures of near television quality. In the machines under trial, users can deny callers video access and also use a self-view mode to look at themselves before going live. Some people seem genuinely horrified by video telephones, says BT's Jim Barron, but within a few years they will be as commonplace as mobile phones. Operators taking part in the European field test include BT, Deutsche Bundespost, France Telecom, Norwegian Telecom, PTT Telecom Netherlands, and SIP in Italy. It's very important that with all these developments going on, that the equipment we end up with can talk to each other, says Steve Gandy, sales and marketing manager at BT Visual and Broadcast Services. We hope the upshot of this test will be closer cooperation between the operators and manufacturers. We are now actively seeking alliances. BT is investing £10 million a year in video telephone R&D and hopes to have machines on the market by next autumn. Initial costs are likely to be in the region of £5,000 for a complete unit connected to an ISDN line. As with any new product and service, the entry cost is quite high, but as the volume increases, the price will fall rapidly. All the manufacturers and operators agree that the most lucrative market will be when the home video telephone business takes off. For this reason, BT is estimating the European market will exceed £3 billion a year within the next 3 years. Such has been the leap forward in equipment development that next year should also see the launch of video telephones for the analog telephone market. These would incorporate 2-inch square screens and a mini camera that would plug into existing telephone sockets. The poor picture quality, however, means that the size of the screen has to be restricted, and the voice quality is also not brilliant, in the words of one manufacturer. However, analog video telephones are seen within the industry as a potential primer for the home market for the eventual arrival of the grander ISDN version. That by Christopher Price in the Financial Times. United Kingdom at night time, this service is also available on 3910. 3910.
Thank you.
Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. In the Sunday Times, Richard Cook proposes a new deal for jazz on the airwaves. Condemned to an unfair hearing. Jazz is not a popular word in the broadcasting media. As far as programme planners are concerned, there are two kinds of jazz audience. A small sect of foaming zealots demanding a diet of incomprehensible saxophone solos, and a cadre of melancholy men waiting for the big bands to come back. Not the sort of profile to encourage any kind of dedicated jazz policy. Consider, after all, Jazz FM, the London independent station, which won the first of the capital's franchises amid much ballyhoo and started up back in the spring of 1990. 18 months later, the station seems embarrassed by its very name. Its new schedules cleared out most of the vestiges of individuality from the station's output and introduced a gentle, wholesome menu that broadcasts as much middle-of-the-road rock as it does jazz. In a typical hour of music, Sting, Van Morrison, J.J. Cale and Steely Dan now take precedence over what little jazz comes up on the station's computer-controlled playlist. Personality presenters have taken to tossing in the catchphrase, "If it sounds good, play it," as if they are as bewildered as anyone else about what qualifies for Jazz FM. What's in a name? Not much, as the radio authority seems to have cheerfully conceded. The original remit for the station was so wide that you could have driven the Victor Sylvester Orchestra through it sideways. Jazz in its widest sense appears to be the key phrase, which naturally can mean anything you like. Although the timid authority has reportedly required the station to play a ratio of at least 1 in 3 instrumental numbers, there seems little sign of any such observance, judging from most of the daytime programming. Since its first 6 months on the air were so feebly directed, the station never fully realised its potential audience, and even the subsequent steady development by the now-dismissed programme director Malcolm Laycock has been brushed aside, and such interesting outposts as the late-night Something Else show have been eradicated. Maybe Jazz FM can now compete with its blander independent rivals. But one is tempted to ask the late Miles Davis's rhetorical question. So what? The problem, though, runs much deeper than one station's troubles. Jazz continues to be the thorniest kind of music to find space for on radio and television alike. If commercial radio has made no attempt at coming to grips with jazz, neither have the BBC's main networks, probably because there seems no feasible place for them to put it. Radio 2's meagre middle-aged jazz programme continues to ignore the substantial audience for the modern end of the music, while Radio 3, despite the precedent of Charlie Fox's memorable and long-running Jazz Today series, seems eternally reluctant to find more than a spare space here and there. It is left to the BBC's local stations to nurture some jazz airtime, and many continue to do so, in the face of periodic rationalisation, which usually ends in so-called specialist programming taking a knock. Television has paid even less mind to the situation. Aside from repeats of the ancient Jazz 625 season, none of the four channels has taken a serious shot at any homegrown jazz programming. A brief series which the BBC completed early last year still has no reported date for broadcasting. Jazz is not a specialist music. There aren't many people who don't like Ella Fitzgerald or Miles Davis or Duke Ellington, but its committed audience is a minority one, which puts it in the same category as opera, chamber music or world music. The audience for jazz is bigger and is growing faster than that for those and other categories, so an Arts Council survey revealed. But surveys influence few. If, as weary fans argue, jazz is to break out of its ghetto, then it needs to be seen and heard on the air. Yet the attempts at broadcasting jazz continue to be so haphazard and half-hearted that the myth of the music being impossible to deal with on radio and TV will continue. It is time that jazz was properly renowned for the quality it is customarily criticised for, as a tough individualistic music. One of Jazz FM's most conspicuous failings was and is its lack of any music with a harder edge, preferring to settle for jazz as a series of harmless oral blandishments, a policy which it has now taken to its logical extreme. Any of the stylistic developments of jazz after 1960 were virtually ignored by the station's programmers. In an era where music and music programming becomes ever more homogenized, the spirit of the individual voice becomes a particular nuisance. Wherever jazz turns up, it is talked down. It is as though, to use opera as an analogy, we must be fed on Gilbert and Sullivan and never be allowed to hear horrid old Wagner. Informed presentation and courageous programming are half the battle, but the first point with which the broadcast media have had to come to terms is simply that jazz is a different animal. Unless it is celebrated in its diversity, the same useless, compromised, half-cocked results are all we'll ever seem to see and hear. Richard Cook, writing in the Sunday Times.
My definition of a bombastic jazz style. Here we go, are you ready for one other? Dream Warriors noise is new, discover all. Once again with a new blend, so telephone a friend.
Yo, Kimoy's got this new song, it's dope, man.
Compact disc to the prime is Optimus. Fans are friends, I'm universal and cosmic. Concrete jungles abound. Stand by the speaker, you're smothered and covered up in the sound. You stand strong as you pump your fist. I'm talking all that jazz. Now what's my definition? My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. Rhymes, it's often said to do damage. Skin so strong, even Superman needs a hand. So bob your head, dread, as I kick the funk flow. This rhyme is subliminal, yeah, you don't think so. I walk with a gold cane, a gold brain, and no gold chain. Behind the truth lies, there lies a parapet. In the mix is where Dream Warriors go. Define if you will, but I know so. There is no definition. My definition, my definition. My definition is this, my definition. My definition, my definition. My definition is this, my definition. My definition is this, my definition. Right now I know it's a flow, it just like a poet. Your definition of me is definitely wrong. Why must I try to lie and build an alibi when all you ask is just for me to be me? Replace a replaceable replacement with this. Relax, relax, relaxation, bombastic. My name is King Lou.
Mine is capital Q.
Bags of mostly water, search to find my definition. My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition is this. My definition.
In The Guardian, fusion dream comes closer to reality. High-tech science promises unlimited environment-friendly power, but the research is hugely expensive. Nigel Williams reports. Harnessing nuclear fusion, the source of the sun's power, to provide energy on Earth, has been one of the dreams of the nuclear age. The prospect of reactors that rely on almost limitless fuel produce virtually no radioactive waste, although some of the reactor components would become radioactive, and have an inherent safety advantage over the current generation of fission reactors, has driven scientists, if not politicians. Fusion power offers big high-tech science the chance to present environmental credentials rivaling those of renewable energy sources, such as solar, tide, and wind power. Fusion does not produce pollutants that cause acid rain or threaten climate change, nor does it pose the fuel transport and disposal problems of present reactors. But the reality has been hugely expensive compared with many other research programs, and the earliest date for commercial viability has receded as costs have risen. Fusion, to its critics, has the reputation of being something of a mirage. The first commercial reactors are unlikely before 2040, and difficult scientific and technical questions have to be answered before a clear development path can be laid out. The joint European Taurus project, JET, at Culham in Oxfordshire, has come closest to demonstrating the feasibility of fusion reactors, and recent results boost hopes that fusion power will be possible. Nuclear fusion experiments enter uncharted areas of physics and present some of the most demanding theoretical challenges. The aim is to heat hydrogen atoms to temperatures up to 10 times higher than the center of the sun, which causes them to break apart and form plasma, a form of matter approached only by lightning under normal circumstances on Earth. Within this plasma, atomic nuclei reform to produce helium and in the process release a great deal of energy. The great challenge of these experiments is confinement. The best tested technology uses magnets surrounding a donut-shaped vacuum chamber, or torus, to keep the plasma under control. The US physicist Edward Teller, a pioneer of fusion research, has said that confining plasma with lines of magnetic force is like trying to confine a jelly with rubber bands. The JET machine, called a tokamak after the Soviet design on which it is based, is the largest torus device in the world. This huge experiment is necessary because, unlike fission, where feasibility can be demonstrated with a small device working at essentially zero power, a useful fusion reaction requires machines not much different in size and power from commercial reactors. The complexity of plasma has emerged from experiments over the past decade. One problem has been controlling its behavior as the temperature is increased. The plasma degrades in a way that has baffled researchers. There are many theories, but experimental evidence has been difficult to obtain because of the extreme conditions within the plasma. Another problem is that impurities from the vessel wall enter the plasma as the temperature increases, limiting performance. The pressing need is to test diverters to keep out impurities, which is why a bid is in for an extension of the JET project until 1996. It is due to be completed next year. The diverters will be ready to be installed in February if the European Community grants the extension. The Council of Ministers approved it last month, and a decision is awaited from the European Parliament. In spite of the snags, JET, the flagship of EC fusion research, has proved an outstanding success. The machine, which began operation in 1983, was designed to study the science of plasmas under conditions approaching those required in a commercial reactor. The latest results strengthen the belief that JET will fulfill that promise. 3 years ago, the United States, the Soviet Union, Japan, and the European Community agreed to a joint effort to design the next step machine, the International Thermonuclear Reactor, ITER, to develop full confidence in the feasibility of fusion. Construction costs are estimated at $5 billion. The EC Fusion Review Board, which reported back to the Commission last year, backs the development of ITER. It wrote, "Fusion can become a reality in the future when the combination of the problems of energy supply and the need to preserve the quality of the environment and global climate mean that it is one of the few remaining practicable options. The board also believes it is not too early to start consulting the public. It argues that funds should be allocated to study the issue of social acceptability." Nigel Williams, writing in The Guardian.